"An apt neo," said Slughorn calmly, pointing his wand at Velby, whose airway seemed to clear at once.
Not much of him, no,
gasped Velby, his eyes streaming.
Well, of course, I dare say he's busy, said Slughorn, looking questioningly at Velby. I doubt he invented the wolf's bane potion without considerable hard work.
I suppose,
said Velby, who seemed afraid to take another bite of pheasant until he was sure that Slughorn had finished with him.
He and my dad don't get on very well, you see, so I don't really know much about.
His voice trailed away as Slughorn gave him a cold smile and turned to McLagan instead.
Now you, Cormac, said Slughorn. I happen to know you see a lot of your Uncle Tiberius, because he has a rather splendid picture of the two of you hunting nogtails in, I think, Norfolk.
Oh, yeah, that was fun, that was, said McLagan. We went with Bertie Hicks and Rufus Scrimgeour. This was before he became minister, obviously.
Ah, you know Bertie and Rufus too?
Beamed Slughorn, now offering around a small tray of pies. Somehow, Velby was missed out.
Now, tell me.
It was as Harry had suspected. Everyone here seemed to have been invited because they were connected to somebody well-known or influential. Everyone except Ginny. Zabini, who was interrogated after McLagan, turned out to have a famously beautiful witch for a mother. From what Harry could make out, she had been married 7 times, each of her husbands dying mysteriously and leaving her mounds of gold. It was Neville's turn next. This was a very uncomfortable 10 minutes, for Neville's parents, well-known aurors, had been tortured into insanity by Bellatrix Lestrange and a couple of Death Eater cronies. At the end of Neville's interview, Harry had the impression that Slughorn was reserving judgment on Neville, yet to see whether he had any of his parents' flair.
"And now?" said Slughorn, shifting massively in his seat with the air of a compere introducing his star act. "Harry Potter! Where to begin? I feel I barely scratched the surface when we met over the summer."
He contemplated Harry for a moment as though he was a particularly large and succulent piece of pheasant, then said,
"The chosen one they're calling you now."
Harry said nothing. Velby, McLagan and Zabini were all staring at him.
"Of course," said Slughorn, watching Harry closely. "There have been rumours for years. I remember when, well, after that terrible night, Lily, James, and you survived, and the word was that you must have powers beyond the ordinary."
Zabini gave a tiny little cough that was clearly supposed to indicate amused scepticism. An angry voice burst out from behind Slughorn.
"Yeah, Zabini, because you're so talented at posing."
"Oh, dear,"
chuckled Slughorn comfortably, looking around at Ginny, who was glaring at Zabini around Slughorn's great belly.
"You want to be careful, please. I saw this young lady perform the most marvelous bat bogey hex as I was passing her carriage. I wouldn't cross her."
Zabini merely looked contemptuous.
"Anyway," said Slughorn, turning back to Harry, "such rumours this summer. Of course, one doesn't know what to believe. The prophet has been known to print inaccuracies, make mistakes. But there seems little doubt, given the number of witnesses, that there was quite a disturbance at the ministry, and that you were there in the thick of it all."
Harry, who could not see any way out of this without flatly lying, nodded, but still said nothing. Slughorn beamed at him.
"So modest, so modest. No wonder Dumbledore is so fond. You were there, then? But the rest of the stories, so sensational, of course. One doesn't quite know what to believe. This fabled prophecy, for instance."
"We never heard a prophecy,"
said Neville, turning geranium pink as he said it.
"That's right," said Ginny staunchly.
Neville and I were both there too, and all this Chosen One rubbish is just the Prophet making things up as usual.
You were both there too, were you?
Said Slughorn with great interest, looking from Ginny to Neville, but both of them sat clam-like before his encouraging smile.
Yes, well, it is true that the Prophet often exaggerates, of course, Slughorn said, sounding a little disappointed. I remember dear Gwenog telling me, Gwenog Jones, I mean, of course, Captain of the Holy Head Harpies.
He meandered off into a long-winded reminiscence, but Harry had the distinct impression that Slughorn had not finished with him, and that he had not been convinced by Neville and Ginny. The afternoon wore on with more anecdotes about illustrious wizards Slughorn had taught, all of whom had been delighted to join what he called the Slug Club at Hogwarts. Harry could not wait to leave, but couldn't see how to do so politely. Finally, the train emerged from yet another long, misty stretch into a red sunset, and Slughorn looked around, blinking in the twilight.
Good gracious! It's getting dark already. I didn't notice that they'd lit the lamps. You'd better go and change into your robes, all of you. McLagan, you must drop by and borrow that book on Nogtails. Harry, please, any time you're passing. Same goes for you, miss.
He twinkled at Ginny.
Well, off you go, off you go.
As he pushed past Harry into the darkening corridor, Zabini shot him a filthy look that Harry returned with interest. He, Ginny and Neville followed Zabini back along the train.
I'm glad that's over, muttered Neville. Strange man, isn't he?
Yeah, he is a bit, said Harry, his eyes on Zabini.
How come you ended up in there, Ginny?
He saw me hex Zachariah Smith, said Ginny. You remember that idiot from Hufflepuff who was in the DA? He kept on and on asking about what happened at the Ministry, and in the end he annoyed me so much I hexed him. When Slughorn came in, I thought I was going to get detention, but he just thought it was a really good hex and invited me to lunch. Mad, eh?
Better reason for inviting someone than because their mother's famous, said Harry, scowling at the back of Zabini's head, or because their uncle... But he broke off. An idea had just occurred to him, a reckless but potentially wonderful idea. In a minute's time, Zabini was going to re-enter the Slytherin sixth-year compartment, and Malfoy would be sitting there thinking himself unheard by anybody except fellow Slytherins. If Harry could only enter, unseen, behind him, what might he not see or hear? True, there was little of the journey left. Hogsmeade Station had to be less than half an hour away, judging by the wildness of the scenery flashing by the windows. But nobody else seemed prepared to take Harry's suspicions seriously, so it was down to him to prove them.
I'll see you two later,
said Harry under his breath, pulling out his invisibility cloak and flinging it over himself.
But what are you...
asked Neville.
Later,
whispered Harry, darting after Zabini as quietly as possible, though the rattling of the train made such caution almost pointless. The corridors were almost completely empty now. Nearly everyone had returned to their carriages to change into their school robes and pack up their possessions. Though he was as close as he could get to Zabini without touching him, Harry was not quick enough to slip into the compartment when Zabini opened the door. Zabini was already sliding it shut when Harry hastily stuck out his foot to prevent it closing.
"What's wrong with this thing?"
said Zabini angrily as he smashed the sliding door repeatedly into Harry's foot. Harry seized the door and pushed it open hard. Zabini, still clinging onto the handle, toppled over sideways into Gregory Goyle's lap, and in the ensuing ruckus, Harry darted into the compartment, leapt onto Zabini's temporarily empty seat, and hoisted himself up into the luggage rack. It was fortunate that Goyle and Zabini were snarling at each other, drawing all eyes onto them, for Harry was quite sure his feet and ankles had been revealed as the cloak had flapped around them. Indeed, for one horrible moment, he thought he saw Malfoy's eyes follow his trainer as it whipped upward out of sight. But then Goyle slammed the door shut and flung Zabini off him,
Zabini collapsed into his own seat, looking ruffled. Vincent Crabbe returned to his comic, and Malfoy, sniggering, lay back down across two seats, with his head in Pansy Parkinson's lap. Harry lay curled uncomfortably under the cloak to ensure that every inch of him remained hidden, and watched Pansy stroke the sleek blonde hair off Malfoy's forehead, smirking as she did so, as though anyone would have loved to have been in her place. The lanterns swinging from the carriage ceiling cast a bright light over the scene. Harry could read every word of Crabbe's comic directly below him.
"So, Zabini," said Malfoy, "what did Slughorn want?"
"Just trying to make up to well-connected people," said Zabini, who was still glowering at Goyle. "Not that he managed to find many."
This information did not seem to please Malfoy.
"Who else had he invited?" he demanded.
"McLagan from Gryffindor," said Zabini.
"Oh, yeah, his uncle's big in the ministry," said Malfoy.
"Someone else called Belby from Ravenclaw?"
"Not him, he's a prat," said Pansy.
"And Longbottom, Potter, and that Weasley girl," finished Zabini.
Malfoy sat up very suddenly, knocking Pansy's hand aside.
"He invited Longbottom?"
"Well, I assume so, as Longbottom was there," said Zabini indifferently.
"What's Longbottom got to interest Slughorn?"
Zabini shrugged.
"Potter, precious Potter, obviously he wanted a look at the Chosen One," sneered Malfoy. "But that Weasley girl, what's so special about her?"
"A lot of boys like her," said Pansy,
watching Malfoy out of the corner of her eyes for his reaction.
"Even you think she's good-looking, don't you, Blaze? And we all know how hard you are to please."
"I wouldn't touch a filthy little blood-traitor like her, whatever she looked like," said Zabini coldly,
and Pansy looked pleased. Malfoy sank back across her lap and allowed her to resume the stroking of his hair.
"Well, I pity Slughorn's taste. Maybe he's going a bit senile. Shame. My father always said he was a good wizard in his day. My father used to be a bit of a favorite of his. Slughorn probably hasn't heard I'm on the train, or..."
"I wouldn't bank on an invitation," said Zabini. "He asked me about Knott's father when I first arrived. They used to be old friends, apparently, but when he heard he'd been caught at the ministry, he didn't look happy. And Knott didn't get an invitation, did he? I don't think Slughorn's interested in Death Eaters."
Malfoy looked angry, but forced out a singularly humorless laugh.
"Well, who cares what he's interested in? What is he, when you come down to it? Just some stupid teacher."
Malfoy yawned ostentatiously.
"I mean, I might not even be at Hogwarts next year. What's it matter to me if some fat old has-been likes me or not?"
"What do you mean you might not be at Hogwarts next year?"
said Pansy indignantly, ceasing grooming Malfoy at once.
"Well, you never know," said Malfoy with the ghost of a smirk. "I might have, moved on to bigger and better things."
Crouched in the luggage rack under his cloak, Harry's heart began to race. What would Ron and Hermione say about this? Crabbe and Goyle were gawping at Malfoy. Apparently they had no inkling of any plans to move on to bigger and better things. Even Zabini had allowed a look of curiosity to mar his haughty features. Pansy resumed the slow stroking of Malfoy's hair, looking dumbfounded.
"Do you mean him?"
Malfoy shrugged.
"Mother wants me to complete my education, but personally I don't see it as that important these days. I mean, think about it. When the Dark Lord takes over, is he going to care how many OWLs or NEWTs anyone's got? Of course he isn't. It'll be all about the kind of service he received, the level of devotion he was shown."
"And you think you'll be able to do something for him?" asked Zabini scathingly. 16 years old and not even fully qualified yet?"
"I've just said, haven't I? Maybe he doesn't care if I'm qualified. Maybe the job he wants me to do isn't something that you need to be qualified for,"
said Malfoy quietly. Crab and Goyle were both sitting with their mouths open like gargoyles. Pansy was gazing down at Malfoy as though she had never seen anything so awe-inspiring.
"I can see Hogwarts," said Malfoy, clearly relishing the effect he had created as he pointed out of the blackened window. "We'd better get our robes on."
Harry was so busy staring at Malfoy he did not notice Goyle reaching up for his trunk. As he swung it down, it hit Harry hard on the side of the head. He let out an involuntary gasp of pain, and Malfoy looked up at the luggage rack, frowning. Harry was not afraid of Malfoy, but he still did not much like the idea of being discovered hiding under his invisibility cloak by a group of unfriendly Slytherins. Eyes still watering and head still throbbing, he drew his wand, careful not to disarrange the cloak, and waited, breath held. To his relief, Malfoy seemed to decide that he had imagined the noise. He pulled on his robes, like the others, locked his trunk, and as the train slowed to a jerky crawl, fastened a thick new traveling cloak around his neck. Harry could see the corridors filling up again, and hoped that Hermione and Ron would take his things out onto the platform for him. He was stuck where he was until the compartment had quite emptied. At last, with a final lurch, the train came to a complete halt. Goyle threw the door open and muscled his way out into a crowd of second years, punching them aside. Crabbe and Zabini followed.
"You go on," Malfoy told Pansy, who was waiting for him with her hand held out as though hoping he would hold it. "I just want to check something."
Pansy left. Now Harry and Malfoy were alone in the compartment. People were filing past, descending onto the dark platform. Malfoy moved over to the compartment door and let down the blinds so that people in the corridor beyond could not peer in. He then bent down over his trunk and opened it again. Harry peered down over the edge of the luggage rack, his heart pumping a little faster. What had Malfoy wanted to hide from Pansy? Was he about to see the mysterious broken object it was so important to mend?
"Petrificus Totalus!"
Without warning, Malfoy pointed his wand at Harry, who was instantly paralyzed. As though in slow motion, he toppled out of the luggage rack and fell with an agonizing, floor-shaking crash at Malfoy's feet, the invisibility cloak trapped beneath him, his whole body revealed with his legs still curled absurdly into the cramped kneeling position. He couldn't move a muscle. He could only gaze up at Malfoy, who smiled broadly.
"I thought so," he said jubilantly. "I heard Goyle's trunk hit you, and I thought I saw something white flash through the air after Zabini came back."
His eyes lingered for a moment upon Harry's trainers.
"You didn't hear anything I care about, Potter. But while I've got you here..."
And he stamped hard on Harry's face. Harry felt his nose break. Blood spurted everywhere.
"That's from my father. Now, let's see."
Malfoy dragged the cloak out from under Harry's immobilized body and threw it over him.
"I don't reckon they'll find you till the train's back in London," he said quietly. "See you around, Potter. Or not."
And, taking care to tread on Harry's fingers, Malfoy left the compartment. Chapter 8 Snape Victorious. Harry could not move a muscle. He lay there beneath the invisibility cloak, feeling the blood from his nose flow, hot and wet, over his face, listening to the voices and footsteps in the corridor beyond. His immediate thought was that someone surely would check the compartments before the train departed again. But at once came the dispiriting realization that even if somebody looked into the compartment, he would be neither seen nor heard. His best hope was that somebody else would walk in and step on him. Harry had never hated Malfoy more than as he lay there like an absurd turtle on its back, blood dripping sickeningly into his open mouth. What a stupid situation to have landed himself in! And now the last few footsteps were dying away. Everyone was shuffling along the dark platform outside. He could hear the scraping of trunks and the loud babble of talk. Ron and Hermione would think that he had left the train without them. Once they arrived at Hogwarts and took their places in the Great Hall, looked up and down the Gryffindor table a few times, and finally realized that he was not there, he, no doubt, would be halfway back to London. He tried to make a sound, even a grunt, but it was impossible. Then he remembered that some wizards, like Dumbledore, could perform spells without speaking. So he tried to summon his wand, which had fallen out of his hand, by saying the words, "Accio wand," over and over again in his head. But nothing happened. He thought he could hear the rustling of the trees that surrounded the lake, and the far-off hoot of an owl, but no hint of a search being made, or even, he despised himself slightly for hoping it, panicked voices wondering where Harry Potter had gone. A feeling of hopelessness spread through him as he imagined the convoy of thestral-drawn carriages trundling up to the school and the muffled yells of laughter issuing from whichever carriage Malfoy was riding in, where he could be recounting his attack on Harry to Crabbe, Goyle, Zabini, and Pansy Parkinson. The train lurched, causing Harry to roll over onto his side. Now he was staring at the dusty underside of the seats instead of the ceiling. The floor began to vibrate as the engine roared to life. The express was leaving, and nobody knew he was still on it. Then he felt his invisibility cloak fly off him, and a voice overhead said, "Watch you, Harry!" There was a flash of red light, and Harry's body unfroze. He was able to push himself into a more dignified sitting position, hastily wipe the blood off his bruised face with the back of his hand, and raise his head to look up at Tonks, who was holding the invisibility cloak she had just pulled away.
"We'd better get out of here quickly,"
she said as the train windows became obscured with steam and they began to move out of the station.
"Come on, we'll jump."
Harry hurried after her into the corridor. She pulled open the train door and leapt onto the platform, which seemed to be sliding underneath them as the train gathered momentum. He followed her, staggered a little on landing, then straightened up in time to see the gleaming scarlet steam engine pick up speed, round the corner, and disappear from view. The cold night air was soothing on his throbbing nose. Tonks was looking at him. He felt angry and embarrassed that he had been discovered in such a ridiculous position. Silently, she handed him back the invisibility cloak.
"Who did it?"
"Draco Malfoy," said Harry bitterly. "Thanks for, well..."
"No problem,"
said Tonks without smiling. From what Harry could see in the darkness, she was as mousy-haired and miserable-looking as she had been when he had met her at the Burrow.
"I can fix your nose if you stand still."
Harry did not think much of this idea. He had been intending to visit Madame Pomfrey, the matron, in whom he had a little more confidence when it came to healing spells. But it seemed rude to say this, so he stayed stock still and closed his eyes.
"Episky," said Tonks.
Harry's nose felt very hot, and then very cold. He raised a hand and felt it gingerly. It seemed to be mended.
"Thanks a lot." "You'd better put that cloak back on and we can walk up to the school," said Tonks, still unsmiling.
As Harry swung his cloak back over himself, she waved her wand. An immense silvery four-legged creature erupted from it and streaked off into the darkness.
"Was that a Patronus?" asked Harry, who had seen Dumbledore send messages like this.
"Yes, I'm sending word to the castle that I've got you, or they'll worry. Come on, we'd better not dawdle."
They set off toward the lane that led to the school.
"How did you find me?"
"I noticed you hadn't left the train, and I knew you had that cloak. I thought you might be hiding for some reason. When I saw the blinds were drawn down on that compartment, I thought I'd check."
"But what are you doing here anyway?" Harry asked.
"I'm stationed in Hogsmeade now to give the school extra protection," said Tonks.
"Is it just you who's stationed up here, or..."
"No, Proudfoot, Savage, and Dawlish are here too."
"Dawlish? That Auror Dumbledore attacked last year?"
"That's right."
They trudged up the dark, deserted lane, following the freshly made carriage tracks. Harry looked sideways at Tonks under his cloak. Last year she had been inquisitive, to the point of being a little annoying at times. She had laughed easily, she had made jokes. Now she seemed older and much more serious and purposeful. Was this all the effect of what had happened at the Ministry? He reflected uncomfortably that Hermione would have suggested he say something consoling about Sirius to her, that it hadn't been her fault at all, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. He was far from blaming her for Sirius's death. It was no more her fault than anyone else's, and much less than his. But he did not like talking about Sirius if he could avoid it. And so they tramped on through the cold night in silence, Tonks's long cloak whispering on the ground behind them. Having always travelled there by carriage, Harry had never before appreciated just how far Hogwarts was from Hogsmeade Station. With great relief, he finally saw the tall pillars on either side of the gates, each top with a winged boar. He was cold, he was hungry, and he was quite keen to leave this new, gloomy Tonks behind, but when he put out a hand to push open the gates, he found them chained shut. "Aloha mora," he said confidently, pointing his wand at the padlock, but nothing happened.
"That won't work on these," said Tonks. "Dumbledore bewitched them himself."
Harry looked around.
"I could climb a wall," he suggested. "No, you couldn't," said Tonks flatly. "Anti-intruder jinxes on all of them. Security's been tightened 100-fold this summer."
"Well then," said Harry, starting to feel annoyed at her lack of helpfulness, "I suppose I'll just have to sleep out here and wait for morning."
"Someone's coming down for you," said Tonks. "Look."
A lantern was bobbing at the distant foot of the castle. Harry was so pleased to see it, he felt he could even endure Filch's wheezy criticisms of his tardiness and rants about how his timekeeping would improve with the regular application of thumbscrews. It was not until the glowing yellow light was 10 feet away from them, and Harry had pulled off his invisibility cloak so that he could be seen, that he recognized with a rush of pure loathing the uplit hook nose and long, black, greasy hair of Severus Snape.
"Well, well, well," sneers Snape, taking out his wand and tapping the padlock once so that the chains snaked backward and the gates creaked open. "Nice of you to turn up, Potter, although you have evidently decided that the wearing of school robes would detract from your appearance."
"I couldn't change. I didn't have my—" Harry began, but Snape cut across him.
"There is no need to wait, Nymphadora. Potter is quite, safe in my hands."
"I meant Hagrid to get the message," said Tonks, frowning.
"Hagrid was late for the start of term feast, just like Potter here, so I took it instead. And incidentally," said Snape, standing back to allow Harry to pass him, "I was interested to see your new Patronus."
He shut the gates in her face with a loud clang and tapped the chains with his wand again so that they slithered, clinking, back into place.
"I think you were better off with the old one," said Snape, the malice in his voice unmistakable. "The new one looks weak."
As Snape swung the lantern about, Harry saw fleetingly a look of shock and anger on Tonks's face. Then she was covered in darkness once more.
"Good night,"
Harry called to her over his shoulder as he began the walk up to the school with Snape.
"Thanks for everything. See you, Harry."
Snape did not speak for a minute or so. Harry felt as though his body was generating waves of hatred so powerful that it seemed incredible that Snape could not feel them burning him. He had loathed Snape from their first encounter, but Snape had placed himself forever and irrevocably beyond the possibility of Harry's forgiveness by his attitude towards Sirius. Whatever Dumbledore said, Harry had had time to think over the summer and had concluded that Snape's snide remarks to Sirius about remaining safely hidden while the rest of the Order of the Phoenix were off fighting Voldemort had probably been a powerful factor in Sirius rushing off to the Ministry the night that he had died. Harry clung to this notion because it enabled him to blame Snape, which felt satisfying, and also because he knew that if anyone was not sorry that Sirius was dead, it was the man now striding next to him in the darkness.
50 points from Gryffindor for lateness, I think," said Snape. "And, let me see, another 20 for your muggle attire. You know, I don't believe any house has ever been in negative figures this early in the term. We haven't even started pudding.
You might have set a record, Potter. The fury and hatred bubbling inside Harry seemed to blaze white hot, but he would rather have been immobilized all the way back to London than tell Snape why he was late.
I suppose you wanted to make an entrance, did you? Snape continued. And with no flying car available, you decided that bursting into the Great Hall halfway through the feast ought to create a dramatic effect.
Still Harry remained silent, though he thought his chest might explode. He knew that Snape had come to fetch him for this, for the few minutes when he could needle and torment Harry without anyone else listening. They reached the castle steps at last, and as the great oaken front doors swung open into the vast flagged entrance hall, a burst of talk and laughter and of tinkling plates and glasses greeted them through the doors standing open into the great hall. Harry wondered whether he could slip his invisibility cloak back on, thereby gaining his seat at the long Gryffindor table, which, inconveniently, was the farthest from the entrance hall, without being noticed. As though he had read Harry's mind, however, Snape said,
"No cloak. You can walk in so that everyone sees you, which is what you wanted, I'm sure."
Harry turned on the spot and marched straight through the open doors, anything to get away from Snape. The great hall, with its four long house tables and its staff tables set at the top of the room, was decorated as usual with floating candles that made the plates below glitter and glow. It was all a shimmering blur to Harry, however, who walked so fast that he was passing the Hufflepuff table before people really started to stare, and by the time they were standing up to get a good look at him, he had spotted Ron and Hermione, sped along the benches toward them, and forced his way in between them.
"Where have you... Blimey! What have you done to your face?"
said Ron, goggling at him along with everyone else in the vicinity.
"Why, what's wrong with it?"
said Harry, grabbing a spoon and squinting at his distorted reflection.
"You're covered in blood," said Hermione. "Come here."
She raised her wand, said, "Turgio," and siphoned off the dried blood.
"Thanks,"
said Harry, feeling his now clean face. "How's my nose looking?"
"Normal," said Hermione anxiously. "Why shouldn't it? Harry, what happened? We've been terrified."
"I'll tell you later," said Harry curtly. He was very conscious that Ginny, Neville, Dean and Seamus were listening in. Even nearly headless Nick, the Gryffindor ghost, had come floating along the bench to eavesdrop.
"But," said Hermione. "Not now, Hermione,"
said Harry in a darkly significant voice. He hoped very much that they would all assume he had been involved in something heroic, preferably involving a couple of Death Eaters and a Dementor. Of course, Malfoy would spread the story as far and wide as he could, but there was always a chance it wouldn't reach too many Gryffindor ears. He reached across Ron for a couple of chicken legs and a handful of chips, but before he could take them, they vanished, to be replaced with puddings.
"You missed the sorting anyway,"
said Hermione, as Ron dived for a large chocolate gâteau. "Hat say anything interesting?" asked Harry, taking a piece of treacle tart.
"More of the same, really. Advising us all to unite in the face of our enemies, you know."
"Dumbledore mentioned Voldemort at all?"
"Not yet. But he always saves his proper speech for after the feast, doesn't he? It can't be long now."
"Snape said Hagrid was late for the feast."
"You've seen Snape? How come?"
said Ron between frenzied mouthfuls of gâteau.
"Bumped into him," said Harry evasively.
"Hagrid was only a few minutes late," said Hermione. "Look, he's waving at you, Harry."
Harry looked up at the staff table and grinned at Hagrid, who was indeed waving at him. Hagrid had never quite managed to comport himself with the dignity of Professor McGonagall, head of Gryffindor House, the top of whose head came up to somewhere between Hagrid's elbow and shoulder as they were sitting side by side, and who was looking disapprovingly at this enthusiastic greeting. Harry was surprised to see the divination teacher, Professor Trelawney, sitting on Hagrid's other side. She rarely left her tower room, and he had never seen her at the start of term feast before. She looked as odd as ever, glittering with beads and trailing shawls, her eyes magnified to enormous size by her spectacles. Having always considered her a bit of a fraud,
Harry had been shocked to discover at the end of the previous term that it had been she who had made the prediction that caused Lord Voldemort to kill Harry's parents and attack Harry himself. The knowledge had made him even less eager to find himself in her company, but thankfully this year he would be dropping divination. Her great beacon-like eyes swiveled in his direction. He hastily looked away toward the Slytherin table. Draco Malfoy was miming the shattering of a nose to raucous laughter and applause. Harry dropped his gaze to his treacle tart, his insides burning again. What he would not give to fight Malfoy one-on-one.
"So what did Professor Slughorn want?"
Hermione asked. "To know what really happened at the Ministry," said Harry.
"Him and everyone else here," sniffed Hermione. "People were interrogating us about it on the train, weren't they, Ron?"
"Yeah," said Ron. "All wanted to know if you really are the Chosen One."
"There has been much talk on that very subject, even amongst the ghosts," interrupted nearly headless Nick, inclining his barely connected head toward Harry so that it wobbled dangerously on its ruff.
"I am considered something of a Potter authority. It is widely known that we are friendly. I have assured the spirit community that I will not pester you for information, however. Harry Potter knows that he can confide in me with complete confidence. I told them I would rather die than betray his trust."
"That's not saying much, seeing as you're already dead," Ron observed.
"Once again, you show all the sensitivity of a blunt axe," said nearly headless Nick in affronted tones, and he rose into the air and glided back toward the far end of the Gryffindor table, just as Dumbledore got to his feet at the staff table. The talk and laughter echoing around the hall died away almost instantly.
"The very best of evenings to you," he said, smiling broadly, his arms opened wide as though to embrace the whole room.
"What happened to his hand?"
gasped Hermione. She was not the only one who had noticed. Dumbledore's right hand was as blackened and dead-looking as it had been on the night he had come to fetch Harry from the Dursleys. Whispers swept the room. Dumbledore, interpreting them correctly, merely smiled and shook his purple and gold sleeve over his injury.
"Nothing to worry about," he said airily. "Now, to our new students, welcome. To our old students, welcome back. Another year full of magical education awaits you."
"His hand was like that when I saw him over the summer,"
Harry whispered to Hermione.
"I thought he'd have cured it by now, though. Or Madame Pomfrey would have done."
"It looks as if it's died,"
said Hermione with a nauseated expression.
"But there are some injuries you can't cure, old curses, and there are poisons without antidotes.
And Mr. Filch, our caretaker, has asked me to say that there is a blanket ban on any joke items bought at the shop called Weasley's Wizard Wheezes. Those wishing to play for their house Quidditch teams should give their names to their heads of house as usual. We are also looking for new Quidditch commentators who should do likewise. We are pleased to welcome a new member of staff this year, Professor Slughorn."
Slughorn stood up, his bald head gleaming in the candlelight, his big waistcoated belly casting the table below into shadow.
"Is a former colleague of mine who has agreed to resume his old post of potions master."
"Potions? Potions?"
The word echoed all over the hall as people wondered whether they had heard right.
"Potions?"
said Ron and Hermione together, turning to stare at Harry.
"But you said..."
"Professor Snape, meanwhile,"
said Dumbledore, raising his voice so that it carried over all the muttering,
"will be taking over the position of Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher."
"No,"
said Harry, so loudly that many heads turned in his direction. He did not care. He was staring up at the staff table, incensed. How could Snape be given the Defense Against the Dark Arts job after all this time? Hadn't it been widely known for years that Dumbledore did not trust him to do it?
"But Harry, you said that Slughorn was going to be teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts," said Hermione.
"I thought he was,"
said Harry, racking his brains to remember when Dumbledore had told him this. But now that he came to think of it, He was unable to recall Dumbledore ever telling him what Slughorn would be teaching. Snape, who was sitting on Dumbledore's right, did not stand up at the mention of his name. He merely raised a hand in lazy acknowledgement of the applause from the Slytherin table, yet Harry was sure he could detect a look of triumph on the features he loathed so much. "Well, that's one good thing," he said savagely. "Snape will be gone by the end of the year."
"What do you mean?" asked Ron.
"That job's jinxed. No one's lasted more than a year. Quirrell actually died doing it. Personally, I'm going to keep my fingers crossed for another death."
"Harry," said Hermione, shocked and reproachful. "He might just go back to teaching potions at the end of the year," said Ron reasonably. "That Slughorn bloke might not want to stay long term. Moody didn't."
Dumbledore cleared his throat. Harry, Ron, and Hermione were not the only ones who had been talking. The whole hall had erupted in a buzz of conversation at the news that Snape had finally achieved his heart's desire. Seemingly oblivious to the sensational nature of the news he had just imparted, Dumbledore said nothing more about staff appointments, but waited a few seconds to ensure that the silence was absolute before continuing.
"Now, as everybody in this hall knows, Lord Voldemort and his followers are once more at large and gaining in strength."
The silence seemed to tauten and strain as Dumbledore spoke. Harry glanced at Malfoy. Malfoy was not looking at Dumbledore, but making his fork hover in midair with his wand, as though he found the headmaster's words unworthy of his attention.
"I cannot emphasize strongly enough how dangerous the present situation is, and how much care each of us at Hogwarts must take to ensure that we remain safe. The castle's magical fortifications have been strengthened over the summer. We are protected in new and more powerful ways, but we must still guard scrupulously against carelessness on the part of any student or member of staff. I urge you, therefore, to abide by any security restrictions that your teachers might impose upon you, however irksome you might find them. In particular, the rule that you are not to be out of bed after hours. I implore you, should you notice anything strange or suspicious within or outside the castle, to report it to a staff member immediately. I trust you to conduct yourselves always with the utmost regard for your own and others' safety."
Dumbledore's blue eyes swept over the students before he smiled once more.
"But now your beds await as warm and comfortable as you could possibly wish, and I know that your top priority is to be well rested for your lessons tomorrow. Let us therefore say good night. Pip, pip."
With the usual deafening scraping noise, the benches were moved back, and the hundreds of students began to file out of the great hall toward their dormitories. Harry, who was in no hurry at all to leave with the gawping crowd, nor to get near enough to Malfoy to allow him to retell the story of the nose stamping, lagged behind, pretending to retie the lace on his trainer, allowing most of the Gryffindors to draw ahead of him. Hermione had darted ahead to fulfill her prefect's duty of shepherding the first years, but Ron remained with Harry.
"What really happened to your nose?"
he asked, once they were at the very back of the throng pressing out of the hall and out of earshot of anyone else. Harry told him. It was a mark of the strength of their friendship that Ron did not laugh.
"I saw Malfoy miming something to do with a nose," he said darkly. "Yeah, well, never mind that," said Harry bitterly. "Listen to what he was saying before he found out I was there."
Harry had expected Ron to be stunned by Malfoy's boasts. With what Harry considered pure pig-headedness, however, Ron was unimpressed.
"Come on, Harry. He was just showing off for Parkinson. What kind of mission would you-know-who have given him?"
"How do you know Voldemort doesn't need someone at Hogwarts? It wouldn't be the first..."
"I wish you'd stop saying that name, Harry," said a reproachful voice behind them.
Harry looked over his shoulder to see Hagrid shaking his head.
"Dumbledore uses that name," said Harry stubbornly.
"Yeah, well, that's Dumbledore, isn't it?"
said Hagrid mysteriously.
"So, how come you were late, Harry? I was worried."
"Got held up on the train," said Harry. "Why were you late?"
"I was with Grawp," said Hagrid happily. "Lost track of the time. He's got a new home up in the mountains now. Dumbledore fixed it. Nice big cave. He's much happier than he was in the forest. We were having a good chat."
"Really?" said Harry, taking care not to catch Ron's eye. The last time he had met Hagrid's half-brother, a vicious giant with a talent for ripping up trees by the roots, his vocabulary had comprised 5 words, two of which he was unable to pronounce properly.
"Oh, yeah, he's really come on," said Hagrid proudly. "You'll be amazed. I'm thinking of training him up as me assistant."
Ron snorted loudly, but managed to pass it off as a violent sneeze. They were now standing beside the oak front doors.
"Anyway, I'll see you tomorrow. First lesson straight after lunch. Come early and you can say hello to Buck. I mean, Witherwings."
Raising an arm in cheery farewell, he headed out of the front doors into the darkness. Harry and Ron looked at each other. Harry could tell that Ron was experiencing the same sinking feeling as himself. "You're not taking care of magical creatures, are you?" Ron shook his head.
"And you're not either, are you?"
Harry shook his head too.
"And Hermione?" said Ron. "She's not, is she?"
Harry shook his head again. Exactly what Hagrid would say when he realized his 3 favorite students had given up his subject, he did not like to think. Chapter 9. The Half-Blood Prince. Harry and Ron met Hermione in the common room before breakfast next morning. Hoping for some support for his theory, Harry lost no time in telling Hermione what he had overheard Malfoy saying on the Hogwarts Express.
"But he was obviously showing off for Parkinson, wasn't he?"
interjected Ron quickly, before Hermione could say anything.
"Well," she said uncertainly, "I don't know. It would be like Malfoy to make himself seem more important than he is, but that's a big lie to tell."
"Exactly," said Harry. But he could not press the point because so many people were trying to listen in to his conversation, not to mention staring at him and whispering behind their hands.
"It's rude to point,"
Ron snapped at a particularly minuscule first-year boy as they joined the queue to climb out of the portrait hole. The boy, who had been muttering something about Harry behind his hand to his friend, promptly turned scarlet and toppled out of the hole in alarm. Ron sniggered.
"I love being a 6th year, and we're going to be getting free time this year. Whole periods when we can just sit up here and relax."
"We're going to need that time for studying, Ron," said Hermione as they set off down the corridor.
"Yeah, but not today," said Ron. "Today's going to be a real doss, I reckon." "Hold it," said Hermione,
throwing out an arm and halting a passing 4th year, who was attempting to push past her with a lime-green disc clutched tightly in his hand.
"Fanged frisbees are banned. Hand it over," she told him sternly.
The scowling boy handed over the snarling frisbee, ducked under her arm, and took off after his friends. Ron waited for him to vanish, then tugged the frisbee from Hermione's grip.
"Excellent! I've always wanted one of these."
Hermione's remonstration was drowned by a loud giggle. Lavender Brown had apparently found Ron's remark highly amusing. She continued to laugh as she passed them, glancing back at Ron over her shoulder. Ron looked rather pleased with himself. The ceiling of the great hall was serenely blue and streaked with frail, wispy clouds, just like the squares of sky visible through the high mullioned windows. While they tucked into porridge and eggs and bacon, Harry and Ron told Hermione about their embarrassing conversation with Hagrid the previous evening.
"But he can't really think we'd continue care of magical creatures," she said, looking distressed. "I mean, when has any of us expressed, you know, any enthusiasm?" "That's it, though, isn't it?"
said Ron, swallowing an entire fried egg whole.
"We were the ones who made the most effort in classes because we like Hagrid. But he thinks we like the stupid subject. Do you reckon anyone's going to go on to the NEWT?
Neither Harry nor Hermione answered. There was no need. They knew perfectly well that nobody in their year would want to continue care of magical creatures. They avoided Hagrid's eye and returned his cheery wave only half-heartedly when he left the staff table 10 minutes later. After they had eaten, they remained in their places, awaiting Professor McGonagall's descent from the staff table. The distribution of class schedules was more complicated than usual this year, for Professor McGonagall needed first to confirm that everybody had achieved the necessary OWL grades to continue with their chosen NEWTs. Hermione was immediately cleared to continue with Charms, Defense Against the Dark Arts, Transfiguration, Herbology, Arithmancy, Ancient Runes, and Potions, and shot off to a first period Ancient Runes class without further ado. Neville took a little longer to sort out. His round face was anxious as Professor McGonagall looked down his application and then consulted his OWL results.
"Herbology, fine," she said. "Professor Sprout will be delighted to see you back with an outstanding OWL. And you qualify for Defense Against the Dark Arts with exceeds expectations. But the problem is Transfiguration. I'm sorry, Longbottom, but an acceptable really isn't good enough to continue to NEWT level. I just don't think you'd be able to cope with the coursework."
Neville hung his head. Professor McGonagall peered at him through her square spectacles.
"Why do you want to continue with Transfiguration anyway? I've never had the impression that you particularly enjoyed it."
Neville looked miserable and muttered something about "my grandmother once."
Snorted Professor McGonagall. "It's high time your grandmother learnt to be proud of the grandson she's got, rather than the one she thinks she ought to have, particularly after what happened at the Ministry."
Neville turned very pink and blinked confusedly. Professor McGonagall had never paid him a compliment before.
"I'm sorry, Longbottom, but I cannot let you into my NEWT class. I see that you have an exceeds expectations in Charms, however. Why not try for a NEWT in Charms?"
"My grandmother thinks Charms is a soft option," mumbled Neville.
"Take Charms," said Professor McGonagall, "and I shall drop Augusta a line reminding her that just because she failed her Charms, OWL, the subject is not necessarily worthless."
Smiling slightly at the look of delighted incredulity on Neville's face, Professor McGonagall tapped a blank schedule with the tip of her wand and handed it, now carrying details of his new classes, to Neville. Professor McGonagall turned next to Parvati Patil, whose first question was whether Ferenczi, the handsome centaur, was still teaching divination.
"He and Professor Trelawney are dividing classes between them this year," said Professor McGonagall, a hint of disapproval in her voice. It was common knowledge that she despised the subject of divination. "The sixth year is being taken by Professor Trelawney."
Parvati set off for divination 5 minutes later, looking slightly crestfallen.
"So, Potter,
said Professor McGonagall, consulting her notes as she turned to Harry.
"Charms, Defense Against the Dark Arts, Herbology, Transfiguration, all fine. I must say, I was pleased with your transfiguration, Mark Potter, very pleased. Now, why haven't you applied to continue with potions? I thought it was your ambition to become an auror."
"It was, but you told me I had to get an outstanding in my OWL, Professor."
"And so you did when Professor Snape was teaching the subject. Professor Slughorn, however, is perfectly happy to accept NEWT students with exceeds expectations at OWL. Do you wish to proceed with potions?"
"Yes," said Harry, "but I didn't buy the books or any ingredients or anything."
"I'm sure Professor Slughorn will be able to lend you some," said Professor McGonagall. "Very well, Potter, here is your schedule. Oh, by the way, 20 hopefuls have already put down their names for the Gryffindor Quidditch team. I shall pass the list to you in due course, and you can fix up trials at your leisure."
A few minutes later, Ron was cleared to do the same subjects as Harry, and the two of them left the table together.
"Look," said Ron delightedly, gazing at his schedule. "We've got a free period now, and a free period after break, and after lunch. Excellent!"
They returned to the common room, which was empty, apart from a half-dozen seventh years, including Katie Bell, the only remaining member of the original Gryffindor Quidditch team that Harry had joined in his first year.
"I thought you'd get that. Well done,"
she called over, pointing at the captain's badge on Harry's chest.
"Tell me when you call trials."
"Don't be stupid," said Harry. "You don't need to try out. I've watched you play for 5 years."
"You mustn't start off like that,"
she said warningly.
"For all you know, there's someone much better than me out there. Good teams have been ruined before now because captains just kept playing the old faces or letting in their friends."
Ron looked a little uncomfortable and began playing with the fanged frisbee Hermione had taken from the fourth-year student. It zoomed around the common room, snarling and attempting to take bites of the tapestry. Crookshank's yellow eyes followed it, and he hissed when it came too close. An hour later, they reluctantly left the sunlit common room for the Defense Against the Dark Arts classroom 4 floors below. Hermione was already queuing outside, carrying an armful of heavy books and looking put upon.
"We got so much homework for runes," she said anxiously
when Harry and Ron joined her.
"A 15-inch essay, 2 translations, and I've got to read these by Wednesday."
"Shame,"
yawned Ron.
"You wait," she said resentfully. "I bet Snape gives us loads."
The classroom door opened as she spoke, and Snape stepped into the corridor, his sallow face framed as ever by 2 curtains of greasy black hair. Silence fell over the queue immediately.
"Inside," he said.
Harry looked around as they entered. Snape had imposed his personality upon the room already. It was gloomier than usual, as curtains had been drawn over the windows and was lit by candlelight. New pictures adorned the walls, many of them showing people who appeared to be in pain, sporting grisly injuries or strangely contorted body parts. Nobody spoke as they settled down, looking around at the shadowy, gruesome pictures.
"I have not asked you to take out your books," said Snape, closing the door and moving to face the class from behind his desk.
Hermione hastily dropped her copy of Confronting the Faceless back into her bag and stowed it under her chair.
"I wish to speak to you, and I want your fullest attention."
His black eyes roved over their upturned faces, lingering for a fraction of a second longer on Harry's than anyone else's.
"You have had 5 teachers in this subject so far, I believe." "You believe, like you haven't watched them all come and go, Snape, hoping you'd be next," thought Harry scathingly. "Naturally, these teachers will all have had their own methods and priorities. Given this confusion, I am surprised so many of you scraped an OWL in this subject. I shall be even more surprised if all of you manage to keep up with the NEWT work, which will be much more advanced."
Snape set off around the edge of the room, speaking now in a lower voice. The class craned their necks to keep him in view.
"The dark arts," said Snape, "are many, varied, ever-changing and eternal. Fighting them is like fighting a many-headed monster, which, each time a neck is severed, sprouts a head even fiercer and cleverer than before. You are fighting that which is unfixed, mutating, indestructible."
Harry stared at Snape. It was surely one thing to respect the dark arts as a dangerous enemy, another to speak of them as Snape was doing, with a loving caress in his voice.
"Your defenses," said Snape a little louder, "must therefore be as flexible and inventive as the arts you seek to undo. These pictures,"
he indicated a few of them as he swept past,
"give a fair representation of what happens to those who suffer. For instance, the Cruciatus curse."
He waved a hand toward a witch who was clearly shrieking in agony.
"Feel the Dementor's kiss.
A wizard lying huddled and blank-eyed, slumped against a wall.
Or provoke the aggression of the Inferius, a bloody mass upon the ground."
"Has an Inferius been seen, then?"
said Parvati Patil in a high-pitched voice.
"Is it definite? Is he using them?"
"The Dark Lord has used Inferi in the past," said Snape, "which means you would be well advised to assume he might use them again. Now."
He set off again around the other side of the classroom toward his desk, and again they watched him as he walked, his dark robes billowing behind him.
"You are, I believe, complete novices in the use of nonverbal speech.